The timing is suspicious, especially given that it was swift in the final decision.
A Canadian is sentenced to death in China. It's Tuesday, January 15th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Check us out on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, is Uganda falling into a Chinese debt trap? Bamboo and bicycles, Trump's border emergency, detecting cancer with a breath, amphibious robots. It's all on today's VOA Asia. A Chinese court has sentenced a Canadian man to death on drug trafficking charges after his previous 15-year sentence was determined to be too lenient. The decision was handed down Monday in the northeast city of Dalian against Robert Lloyd Schellenberg, who was originally detained in 2014. Schellenberg has denied the charges against him, and his lawyer, Zhang Zhongxiu, told Reuters that he would likely appeal the sentence. The decision will likely aggravate an already strained relations between Canada and China over what appear to be retaliatory steps taken by China after Canadian authorities arrested a Chinese tech company executive. Meng Wanzhou, the chief financial officer for Huawei, was arrested in Vancouver December 1st on behalf of the United States, which is seeking her extradition over alleged violations of U.S. trade sanctions on Iran. Following the arrest, China detained two Canadian citizens in China on national security charges. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke about this with Margaret Lewis, a law professor at Seton Hall University's Law School, whose research focuses on law in mainland China. She says it's difficult to clearly determine what has occurred and the reasons why.
The challenge with China is there's so much we don't know. The timing is suspicious, especially given that it was swift in the final decision, but this case languished in the courts for years prior to the detention of Meng Wanzhou in early December. And the shift from slow gear to a rapid decision to have a much more severe sentence is definitely suspicious.
Suspicious. Is there any precedent of something like this happening before?
Precedent is difficult when you lack transparency. The number of executions in China remains a state secret, despite the courts in China publishing vast amounts of data that is curated to leave out particularly death sentences that in a way that would allow us to figure out patterns over time. The fact that this has happened not only so quickly after the December detention in Canada, but also with the Chinese government not just allowing but welcoming foreign attention to these proceedings, makes it so there's not a long inferential bridge to say the two things are likely connected.
Canada is in a position, and I take it from what you've said, they've almost put themselves in this position as between a rock and a hard place between China and the United States. Do you agree?
I think that Canada put itself in the position of enforcing its laws and cooperating with its partners in international law enforcement, that Canada would, after receiving information from the United States, hold someone pending an extradition proceeding is how the law is supposed to operate. I think the country here that's ramped up the pressure and made this into a political decision is China.
Let's talk about Robert Lloyd Schellenberg. He has been in jail for quite some time, and now he has been given the death sentence, and the Chinese say they have information that he was trying to distribute and sell methamphetamine, and transport it to Australia. Is there any validity to that that you can see?
Again, we know what the Chinese government wants us to know, but if indeed it was 222 kilograms or anything close to that amount, I mean, that's greater weight than I think the size of a large male gorilla. That's a lot of drugs. I mean, that's taken very seriously under Chinese law, even if there is no political overtone. That is an offense, smuggling drugs of quantities, even of much lesser amounts, that could be subject to the death penalty. So as far as applying the death penalty to a case involving drug smuggling, that's not shocking. What is questionable here is that we have bits and pieces of information about the government's case. And it sounds like the government's theory of the case shifted from Mr. Schellenberg being a relatively low-level player in this alleged drug smuggling operation to then saying he actually was a core participant, much higher responsibility in this plan. That shift, if indeed true, that someone was more involved in the planning, would be a relevant factor in Chinese law with respect to sentencing, along with the weight of the drugs and other factors.
This is not the first action that has been taken against Canadians who are in China. Two people have been arrested or detained or whatever. Where does this go from here?
Anyone's guess. So if we just had one data point, it would be concerning. We now have several data points of Canadians who, since December 1st, have in a very high-profile manner been held, or in this case, sentenced to the death sentence. The more data points we have and the more statements we have out of whether it be Chinese diplomats abroad or other mouthpieces of the Chinese government, the more that it sounds like this is, you know, an attempt to up the pressure on the Canadian government to bend to the wishes of Beijing. One thing I noted in what information we've received so far in Mr. Schellenberg's case is that he has been sentenced to death with essentially not immediate execution, but fairly rapid execution under the criminal procedure law. Another possibility would have been going from the original 15-year sentence to death with a 2-year reprieve, a suspended death sentence. And the court reports indicate that at least one other person involved in this alleged operation did receive that sentence, which is often commuted to a long prison sentence. So what Mr. Schellenberg received was the most severe sentence available under Chinese law.
Margaret Lewis, a law professor at Seton Hall University's Law School, whose research focuses on law in mainland China. She was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. In recent years, China has executed citizens from several foreign countries, including Britain, Japan, and the Philippines, following convictions on drug charges. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. China sentences Canadian to death for drug smuggling. China reports record trade surplus with United States amid signs of slowing economy. Voice recorder of crashed Indonesian jetliner found. Russia toughens stance in islands dispute with Japan. China says it exchanged data with NASA on far side moon landing. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia. Also stop by the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Uganda's finance minister has rejected concerns that the country risks losing its national assets to China with conditions placed on major loans. Uganda has borrowed about $3 billion from China's state banks for development projects ranging from highways to power production to oil exploration, as Halima Atumani reports from Kampala.
Uganda's finance minister, Matia Kasaija, this week insisted that its growing debt is sustainable and the country is not at risk of losing state assets to China. Uganda's Auditor General, in a report released this month, warned public debt from June 2017 to 2018 had increased from $9.1 billion to $11.1 billion. The report, without naming China, warned conditions placed on major loans were a threat to Uganda's sovereign assets. It said that in some loans, Uganda had agreed to waive sovereignty over properties if it defaults on the debt, a possibility that Kasaija rejected.
China taking over assets? I don't know. I have heard, but in Uganda, I've told you, as long as some of us are still in charge, unless there is a real catastrophe, which I don't see at all, that will make this economy going behind. So I'm not worried about China taking assets. They can do it elsewhere, I don't know, but here I don't think it will come.
China is one of Uganda's biggest country lenders, with about $3 billion in development projects through state-owned banks. China's Exim Bank has funded about 85% of two major Ugandan power projects, Karuma and Isimba Dams. It also financed and built Kampala's $476 million Entebbe Express Highway to the airport, which cuts time in the car by more than half. China's National Offshore Oil Corporation, France's Total, and Britain's Tullow Oil co-own Uganda's western oil fields, set to be tapped by 2021. Economist Fred Muhumza says China's foot in Uganda's oil could be one way it decides to take back what is owed.
So they might determine the price as part of recovering their loan. By having a foot in there, they would say, fine, we are going to pay you for oil, but instead of giving you $60 a barrel, you owe us. We'll give you 55. The 5, you are paying the old debt. But we're reaching a level where you don't see this oil being an answer to the current debt problem.
Uganda's worries about China seizing national assets are not the first in Africa. A leaked December report in Kenya showed China was promised parts of Mombasa port as collateral for financing a $3 billion railway it built from the port to Nairobi. Both Chinese and Kenyan officials have denied that the port's ownership is at risk. Reports in September that China was taking over Zambia's state power company over unpaid debt rippled across Africa despite government denials. But the fear of a Chinese takeover of a sovereign state's assets over debt is not completely without merit. Struggling to pay back loans to state-owned Chinese firms, Sri Lanka in 2017 handed over a strategic port. Halima Athmani, for VOA News, Kampala.
Happening now in Asia, Indonesian officials say search crews have discovered the cockpit voice recorder from the Lion Air jetliner that crashed in the Java Sea last October. The voice recorder will help answer why the plane suddenly dove into the water, killing all 189 passengers and crew on board. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're always glad to have you with us on VOA Asia. Thanks for listening. Bamboo and bicycles might be thought of as being more closely associated with Asia rather than Africa, but an entrepreneur in Uganda has found a way to reduce, reuse, and recycle when it comes to broken metal bicycles. He refurbishes them with a highly renewable plant, bamboo, and in doing so, he's now turning a profit and creating jobs. We take a ride with VOA's Arash Arabasadi for details.
In his workshop in Uganda's capital, an entrepreneur inspects his handiwork. Nurdin Kasoma found a way to fix old, broken steel bicycles using super renewable bamboo, creating something that he can sell.
When it comes to the bamboo bicycle and riding, especially on the off-roads, it's really comfortable. One, bamboo is flexible. Due to that flexibility, gives that kind of shock-absorbing property. When you're riding, especially on the off-roads, the bamboo itself tries to absorb the shocks that you're passing through, other than steel or aluminium.
Kasoma learned to make bikes after training with an American designer and watching online tutorials. He says he wanted to make bikes more affordable than conventional brands. Bamboo bikes, which have been around for more than a century, seemed like a good way to go.
I think it's a cheaper option. Because if you went through importing a carbon frame, the taxes and the like, you suddenly may buy two of these in a frame.
It takes Kasoma about a week to make each bike, and they cost between $350 and $450. He also employs about 20 workers plus young apprentices to whom he teaches the craft.
We get geometrical diagrams of different types of bikes and different sizes. We normally make mountain bikes, city bikes, and travel bikes, and then we have the road bikes, the racing bikes. So every type of bicycle has different geometry and different sizes.
Kasoma says he uses bamboo because it grows fast, is everywhere, and is a sustainable crop. He is working on plans to expand his factory and expand bicycle tourism in Uganda. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
Coming up, the latest on the U.S. government partial shutdown. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov is visiting Tokyo to meet with his Japanese counterpart, Taro Kono, on a potential peace treaty between the two nations and an upcoming summer visit to Japan by Russian President Vladimir Putin. Your visit to VOA Asia Facebook can happen anytime you like. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues with the partial shutdown of the federal government now in its fourth week, President Donald Trump continues to hold out the possibility that he will declare a national emergency along the southern border with Mexico. Trump could use the declaration to fund his long-sought border wall, but Democrats and even some Republicans oppose the idea as an overreach of executive authority. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
President Trump at the southern border, seeking to deliver on his central campaign promise of a border wall with Mexico. But with Democrats in Congress firmly opposed to the wall, Trump continues to consider declaring a national emergency to fund it.
I have the absolute legal right to call it, but I'm not looking to do that because this is too simple. The Democrats should say we want border security, we have to build a wall, otherwise you can't have border security, and we should get on with our lives.
Some Republicans believe that may be a way out of the government shutdown. Yet Democrats oppose an emergency declaration. Presidents generally have a lot of leeway to declare a national emergency, says analyst John Hudak.
The president has a fairly broad power to declare a national emergency. According to a pretty firm reading of that law, it's hard to see where there is an exception to the president's ability to do it.
But Hudak notes there are constitutional limits on the president's power.
Presidents have tried to go around Congress in terms of spending money in the past, and frequently presidents are stopped because the spending power in the Constitution rests with the Congress.
Public opinion polls show more Americans blame Trump for the shutdown than opposition Democrats. But the president remains focused on his political base, says Larry Sabato.
This isn't going to end until at least parts of Trump's base agree to go along or say, well, you tried your best. Those darn Democrats just won't give in.
Trump's strategy involves high political risk, says John Hudak.
President Trump is playing to his base here, but unfortunately his base is a small percentage of the population, and most of the rest of the population is not with him on this issue of the wall.
Trump is counting that his commitment to building the wall will shore up his political base for his re-election bid next year. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
This news from VOA Asia. Malaysia's National Zoo threw a surprise first birthday party for a female giant panda cub born to parents on loan from China. After nibbling at some carrots used to decorate her birthday cake, the panda, who has not yet been named, seemed to tire of the celebrations and fell asleep. We'll keep you more entertained when you visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, esophageal cancer in the long, hollow tube that runs from your throat to your stomach is one of the most frequently reported malignancies and a leading cause of cancer deaths around the world. Most cases are reported in developing countries. Early esophageal cancer typically causes no signs or symptoms. However, the chemical markers of the disease are present even in the earliest stages. VOA's Faith Lapidus tells us about a new device being tested in England to take advantage of that and allow early detection of several types of cancer.
Sensors, originally developed for detecting explosives and toxic gases, have been reprogrammed to identify the chemical markers of cancer. The breathalyzer, created by Owlstone Medical, can detect and identify multiple chemicals in a gas flow at very low concentrations, typically parts per billion. The 1,500 people in the clinical trial will wear a special mask fitted with collection tubes and breathe normally for 10 minutes. Lead investigator Rebecca Fitzgerald says it's a simple procedure.
These tubes, simple though they look, this is one of the things that's made a real difference in this technology looking so promising, because for the first time, the chemicals that are breathed out in the breath can be collected in these tubes and immediately stabilized. So as you keep breathing, you're capturing more and more of those chemicals, and you're building up a profile of the chemicals in your body that have been exhaled on the breath.
The tubes are then sent to Owlstone's lab, where the volatile organic compounds in the breath are analyzed. Those VOCs, as they're called, are produced by the body's normal metabolism. Changes in metabolic activity can produce particular patterns of VOCs, which can be biomarkers of specific diseases. By picking out minute traces of cancer, Owlstone's co-founder Billy Boyle says treatment can begin early, with a greater chance of success.
The challenge is most people present when it's very late stage, and it's about managing symptoms as opposed to curing them. So the key thing that you can do is detect the disease early, and that's what we think the breathalyzer technology allows for, picking it up at that earliest stage when it's treatable.
The trial is currently limited to patients with suspected esophageal and stomach cancers, but will be extended later to include patients with other cancers. And doctors will be watching the 2-year trial closely. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Nature finds a way, as the old saying goes. We see it in how animals fly, crawl, slink, dig, and otherwise make their way through the world. Scientists have long recognized the ways in which evolution has perfected movement in the natural world and mimicked it in their robot designs. The latest design, as VOA's Kevin Enix explains, is simple and incredibly complicated all at the same time.
Watch the way this cuttlefish moves, quick and sure, even without legs. Now look at the velox. While it's not quite as quick and sure of itself as the cuttlefish, Benjamin Filardo from Pliant Energy Systems says it can do things the cuttlefish can't.
One of the key advantages of the Velox robot is that it's able to move from the water onto land and back again. And it turns out that this particular way of creating a moving, undulating fin, with one fin you can go through snow, you can go over sand, swim pretty well, and also ice skate. So this is the first robot that we're aware of that can swim at the surface of the water, can swim down under the water, and also move pretty well on land.
The Velox switches from water to land by just changing the ways its fins move.
If we put the fins down low and we go to a shorter wavelength, now this is a land crawling. So if it would swim up to the shore, then it will go into this mode and it would start to crawl up the sand.
Filardo says their team didn't set out to copy the cuttlefish, but that this propulsion system is just what happened when they took into account all they knew about physics and fluid dynamics. Movement systems like this one have big advantages over blades or wheels.
Compared with a bladed system, one of the great advantages of an undulating fin is it won't get tangled. So if you have debris-filled water, it won't become entangled in plant matter. So this can go through swamps, it can go through very heavily debris-laden water. It can swim effectively through mud and potentially sewage and even some very viscous fluids such as oil. So potentially you can envisage a robot like this swimming up oil pipelines to do inspections. The bladed system is going to have trouble with that viscosity.
Right now, the Velox requires a person to tell it what to do, but the team is working on a fully autonomous version, as well as ways to incorporate the unique propulsion system into scuba suits and boats. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find our full-length programs on iTunes and SoundCloud for you to download and take wherever you go. You can also find us on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you. Send us a note. VOAAsia@voanews.com is our email address. We also like to thank everybody who's listening on the radio. Radioactive at Temasek Polytechnic in Singapore carries our program. Hi to everybody there who is listening. We say thank you to our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Aydin Utku, our managing editor, Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook on our VOA Asia team. Have a great day.